1996 Sunstone Symposium presents session number 252, Dialogue, The Early Years, a paper by Devery S. Anderson, with comments by G. Wesley Johnson. Please note that because this is a 60-minute session, the last 30 minutes on the second side of this tape will be blank.
I'm Linda Lindstrom, chair of this session, titled Dialogue, The Early Years. Our presenter is Devery Anderson. He lives in Salt Lake City and has three children. He's working on a bachelor's degree in history from the University of Utah and will graduate in December. And then the following fall, he's going to enter a master's degree program in history. He's writing a history of dialogue that will be forthcoming in the 30th anniversary issue of Dialogue. And he's also writing a biography of Willard Richards. Responding to Devery's paper will be G. Wesley Johnson. He lives in Provo, is married, and has four children. He has a BA from Harvard, MA, and PhD from Columbia. He's a professor of history and political science at BYU, adjunct professor of business history at the Marriott School of Management at BYU, and a partner in Ashby and Johnson Consulting Historians. Wesley was also the first editor of Dialogue, along with Eugene England. Devery will speak about 30 minutes, and then Wesley will make comments for about 15 minutes, and then hopefully we'll have time for questions and comments.
Well, as she said, all my degrees are forthcoming, and so now that it's on tape, I guess I have no choice. And as far as that master's degree goes, I'm planning on starting that the following fall, but I took a French final this morning, and I'm beginning to wonder if that's going to happen. I may be at McDonald's flipping burgers the rest of my life. But for over 30 years, Dialogue, a journal of Mormon thought, has occupied a position that Alan Roberts once described as the, quote, patriarch or matriarch, unquote, of independent Mormon scholarship. As of today, the journal is midway through its 29th volume. Its survival through three often turbulent decades is in many ways remarkable, considering the increase in anti-intellectual activity in the LDS hierarchy and the effect this has had on Mormons in general. This paper will look at the early years chronologically from the period of from the journal's conception in 65 until the first editorial team moved on in 1971. And also I'd like to let's talk about the contrast the climate that was then and compared to that which we have now, that when once upon a time intellectuals were somewhat valued, and today they're dubbed as so-called scholars and intellectuals. Wesley Johnson and Eugene England, two of the founding editors of Dialogue, were each dreaming of an independent journal that would unify and bring together an otherwise scattered group of Mormons. Unknown to each other, they were sharing the idea with friends by the late 1950s. Johnson even made the subject of an independent journal the subject of a sacrament meeting talk in 1958. 7 years later, however, it was, as England puts it, quote, an idea whose time had come, unquote. In 1965, England was a student at Stanford University and Johnson was a professor of history there. They began sharing their interest in founding a journal with Diane Monson, a political scientist at Brigham Young University who was then visiting California. Three others, Joseph Jebson, Francis Menlove, and Paul Salisbury, were approaching Monson individually also, telling her that they, too, were interested in starting a journal for thinking Mormons. Monson soon suggested that the Stanford Five get acquainted and combine their talents. With excitement and optimism, they began meeting in June of 1965 and decided that they had everything except money to get the project moving. This problem was temporarily solved when each of them pledged $50 to finance a prospectus. Written by England and approved by the others, the prospectus was sent to about 500 friends. It stated in part, quote, many men need some medium in which to consider their historical and religious heritage in relation to contemporary experience and secular learning. Some are excited about the dialogue this encounter provides and the good fruit it bears in their lives. Others find themselves alone in their experience and cut off from such a dialogue, and too often feel forced to choose between their heritage and the larger world. We are now preparing to publish a journal designed to meet the needs of both these groups. It will be edited by Mormons who value the life of the mind in all its variety and who wish to respond to their Mormon heritage in the context of human experience as a whole. We believe there are many in the Mormon community and in other communities of belief or experience who will find the resulting dialogue interesting and valuable. Unquote. Response to the first mailing was immediate and encouraging. People began subscribing to the journal before the group even decided on a price. One person anonymously donated $100 cash. From then on, remembers England 10 years later, we didn't have to put any money in ourselves. We were able to finance everything from the money that came, which, as I look back, is amazing. The phenomenal interest resulting from the prospectus was an indication of the need for the journal these young Mormons wanted to produce. As the project progressed, others from around the country wrote and told the group that they, too, were about to begin a similar journal, but now they are willing to support the project at Stanford. After toying with various names, like Kairos, which means the redeemed time, the team decided to call the new journal Dialogue. The subtitle, A Journal of Mormon Thought, sparked criticism from some in the church hierarchy, Remembers England. I guess with the implication it was the Journal of Mormon Thought. Although the journal was to be an independent voice, the founders decided to inform church leaders of their plans. Richard L. Bushman, then professor of history at Brigham Young University and the book review editor for Dialogue, drafted a 2-page letter on 25 October 1965 to the First Presidency, explaining the purpose of the new journal. England suggested that it be shortened to 1 page and that, quote, the letter should arrive just before Thanksgiving. It should be a warm and fairly formal letter, signed perhaps by myself and you, unquote. The founders proceeded with caution when informing the Mormon church leaders of their plans. The letter could shape the attitudes of the brethren for good or ill. After England suggested a paragraph of testimony and loyalty to the brethren, Bushman wrote back that, quote, Doug Alder is a son-in-law of A. Hamer Reiser. Doug says that people are always lobbying the brethren for one cause or another, and invariably they pour on their testimony. The presidency much prefers that people level with them, say clearly what they want, and end. According to England, a positive reaction from the brethren was taken for granted. Quote, I just assumed they would approve. I saw our project as wholly in accord with the church's mission and a contribution to it. He continues, one of my growing interests as an institute teacher at Stanford was young people in the church and their problems and needs as they were faced with intellectual challenges at college. I realized that the official church wasn't doing much for them. Perhaps it shouldn't. There wasn't any particular reason. This was a new problem that was developing. In the spirit of the lay church, I felt that people who saw the problem should try to do something about it. This concern for young people was the focus of the letter to the First Presidency. Quote, institute classes in the church schools help a large number, Bushman wrote to them, but unfortunately these methods do not reach certain ones, including some of the finest students. We believe dialogue can help reach these young people, unquote. Bushman's edited letter to the First Presidency, dated 20 November, went unanswered. Instead, a statement was published in the church's quarterly priesthood bulletin in response, quote, to questions from stake and ward leaders and from individual members. Church leaders here stated that the new journal was not a church publication, and hence the contents, quote, are never submitted to church authorities for approval and therefore are the sole responsibility of the editors, unquote. England remembers that this is exactly what we hoped for and expected. At the suggestion of Johnson, the group established an editorial board. The first board was impressive. Among those recruited was future Brigham Young University president and later apostle Dallin H. Oaks, then a professor at the University of Illinois Law School. Although he initially saw the project, quote, as a rather leftish outfit, unquote, his interest grew when he was assured that, quote, we had no pot shots, unquote. Chase Peterson, later the president of the University of Utah, also joined the team. But some were reluctant to serve, however. Church education employee Kenneth Godfrey declined to be on the board. He did so at the command of his stake president, of whom he had asked permission. This local leader, referring to the editors as, quote, the modern Godbeites, unquote, told Godfrey to, quote, stay away from them. The group also had an interest in Henry B. Eyring, who was also later, as you know, called to be an apostle. He turned them down, too. He said, quote, I think that what you are doing is marvelous. I think it's needed by the church and that the Lord probably wants it, but I'll have nothing to do with it because it would disturb some of the general authorities and because it would disturb some of the general authorities, and he didn't want to do that. As a member of the bishopric of the Stanford ward, England recruited 10 to 20 young members in that ward to help with the necessities, typing the mailing lists and subscription forms, answering mail, and readying the manuscripts for publication. This volunteer effort lasted for over a year and a half. England remembers it as a spiritual experience. These evenings at the ward were opened with prayer, and the students found the effort gratifying. Johnson remembers that not only students were helping, but Stanford faculty and library personnel were also giving their time. Quote, people felt they were doing something special, unquote, according to Johnson. The editors tried to publicize Dialogue in both Salt Lake City newspapers, but a notice in the Mormon-owned Deseret News and an article for the literary page of the Sunday Salt Lake Tribune were both rejected. Both papers insisted that space problems, not the nature of the quarterly, were the reasons. And so the group went to paid advertising instead. But thanks to the BYU directory of LDS scholars, the group had immediate access to around 5,000 names. A brochure printed in late fall and sent to these individuals increased subscriptions dramatically. Now, some of the best publicity came from the national media. The New York Times featured an article in December of 1965 talking about young Mormons now planning a journal. And that was followed a few months later in an article in Time magazine, which featured an article and photos of Johnson in England. They were also interviewed for CBS and NBC. The five founders all served as part of the first editorial staff. England and Johnson were announced as the managing editors. Francis Menlove took the duty as manuscripts editor. The job of publication editor went to Paul Salisbury. Joseph Jebson filled the role as notes and comments editor. And Diane Monson, who had gotten the group originally together, agreed to serve on an editorial board. At the invitation of the history department at Stanford, part of Johnson's office became home to the journal. A post office box was also established. And from Dialogue's conception in June of 1965, the first issue would be mailed within 9 months. Shortly before Dialogue appeared in March 1966, the journal had already had 1,100 subscribers. By May, it would boast 2,400. By late October, 3,400 people were receiving the journal, and by the end of the first year, total subscriptions surpassed 5,000. In the premier issue, Dialogue lived up to its expectations. Salisbury, an architect by profession, designed the cover and layout. Johnson and England both wrote introductions explaining the purpose of the journal. The lead article was Leonard J. Arrington's Scholarly Studies of Mormonism in the 20th Century. Menlove contributed the article called The Challenge of Honesty. To further aid the thinking Mormon were Victor Klein's The Faith of a Psychologist, a personal document, and Claude Burtonshaw's The Student, His University, and His Church. Non-Mormon Mario S. DePillis of the University of Massachusetts published The Quest for Religious Authority and the Rise of Mormonism. A roundtable discussed the theological foundations of the Mormon religion by Sterling McMurrin, a book which examined Mormon theology from a non-traditional perspective. This issue also included the only contribution ever to appear by Truman Madsen, then director of the Institute of Mormon Studies at BYU, titled Joseph Smith and the Sources of Love. Now, responses to Dialogue's debut were enthusiastic. Declaring the journal long overdue and badly needed, one subscriber wrote that he knew of, quote, scores of young college graduates who have been driven from the church by the narrow-minded type of Mormon who seems to be in charge at this time, unquote. Mormon writer Samuel W. Taylor declared Dialogue the best thing to happen to Mormon literature in the modern age. But not everyone issued a positive critique. Ray Chandler, who called himself prophet and seer of the Center Place in Independence, Missouri, after initially expressing hope that, quote, your new venture will be a veritable success, unquote, wrote that after examining the first issue and throwing it into the waste paper basket, that, quote, I am thoroughly disgusted. In explaining himself 10 days later, Chandler elaborated, I had expected Dialogue could be a lifeline between Jesus Christ and man, but the illusion has been proven inadequate, and undoubtedly the saying is true as far as theology is concerned, that God is dead. The only Mormon general authority to send a written opinion in the beginning was S. Dilworth Young, a member of the Council of 70. He was concerned that, quote, sooner or later you're going to run out of material, which will be the solid opinion of the leaders of the church, past or present, unquote. With that happening, quote, the material is bound to become speculative, and that could cause trouble. This trouble, according to Young, would be from liberals pushing their own particular ideas. Quote, if you do resist them, they likely will brand you as prejudiced, and with that brand on you, you will likely try to remove the brand by proving that you are not. Young concludes with a warning. I know you are sincere, but in your sincerity, remember that undeviating loyalty to the church leaders, First Presidency and the Twelve, is the only standard you can maintain if you want the approbation of the church. End quote. How much of a risk do we want to take in order to make dialogue useful? England asked Bushman 2 days later. Perhaps the answer is that we're still too young to know and had better err on the conservative side. Elder Young also took issue with England's editorial in the Premier issue, entitled The Possibility of Dialogue. Here, England calls for Latter-day Saints to consider the possibility that they may be mistaken about many of their long-held ideas. In response to Young, who felt that this was not, in his view, a position that a Latter-day Saint could take, England writes that the LDS missionary program asks people, quote, to question their most cherished beliefs, to consider the possibility that they might be dead wrong about things they have built their lives upon. With such an approach, England asks, how can we ask less of ourselves when we, in an indirect proselyting effort like dialogue, offer to talk with people about our religious heritage? A letter from BYU professor Robert Thomas, who was slated to provide a sermon in the second issue, was also a blow. Quote, you mentioned that several general authorities seem to be either favorable or non-committed. I'm afraid my experience with them in regard to dialogue is not so encouraging, unquote. Disappointed with the content of the journal, Thomas withdrew his support and the promised manuscript. The general authorities received free subscriptions during the Johnson England term. A few, such as Marion D. Hanks, Paul H. Dunn, and First Presidency Counselor Hubie Brown, were supportive of the enterprise. Brown was instrumental in preventing BYU President Ernest Wilkinson from banning dialogue from the university bookstore. During a meeting of the Board of Trustees where Wilkinson made his complaint, Brown reminded him that perhaps other publications carried there needed to be banned also. Quote, this brought the discussion to an end. Unquote. Brown's support went so far as to suggest to England that dialogue combined with BYU studies as an intellectual journal with official church sanction. Whether he felt that church approval would assure a long life for the journal or that it would be a means to reach a larger number of people is unknown, but there was never any attempt to institutionalize dialogue, although I'm sure the brethren would have liked to have institutionalized President Brown after making that kind of a suggestion. Whether he felt... And Eldon Tanner, also the First Presidency, encouraged England to publish material critical of the church in each issue so that members could know that the journal was not church-sanctioned. Early challenges also came in the form of manuscripts or lack of publishable ones. Bushman says, I think we'll always be short of good ones. I doubt if we can ever sit back and let people come to us. Several of the early submissions were written years before, waiting for the opportunity to be published. Rejecting up to 90% of submitted material, England and Johnson remember the early years as a time of weeding out. Accused of being solely a liberal publication, the editors sought people to contribute to the journal who would be able to provide balance. Bushman invited Neil A. Maxwell, then executive vice president of the University of Utah, to contribute. Maxwell wrote that, quote, I fully intend, unquote, to submit something, although he never did. The editors also wanted Truman Madsen to continue publishing in the journal, but after his piece in the Premier issue, he declined any future involvement. According to England, Madsen was given, quote, a look by a general authority, which meant that he, quote, probably shouldn't write for dialogue, and he never did. Elder Marion D. Hanks, willing to contribute, was denied permission by the president of the church. The only general authority to publish in dialogue was President Hubie Brown, and his funeral sermon for retired BYU English professor P.A. Christensen was published in the spring 1969 issue. Maintaining a moderate stance proved to be the journal's biggest challenge. Sometimes the editors brought the problems on themselves. In retrospect, England maintains that he used poor judgment in publishing a letter in the summer 1967 issue by church member Stuart Udall, Secretary of the Interior under Presidents Kennedy and Johnson, which attacked the church policy then in effect on the race issue, which at the time, of course, denied the priesthood to black males. Because he was interested in fostering constructive dialogue concerning Mormonism and the Negro, England was at first enthusiastic about Udall's piece. Initially intended as part of a roundtable, the editors decided to publish it as a letter to the editor instead. Udall, writing that he, quote, wanted to send advance copies of the text along with an explanatory letter to President McKay and other members of the general authorities, requested some copies of his letter from dialogue in its finalized form. Criticizing the racial policy, Udall, according to England, used his letter to increase his political standing in the media. quote, "My fear is that the very character of Mormonism is being distorted and crippled by adherence to a belief and practice that denies the oneness of mankind," wrote Udall. Urging a change in policy, he maintained that, quote, "The restriction now imposed on Negro fellowship is a social and institutional practice having no real sanction in essential Mormon thought. It is clearly contradictory to our most cherished spiritual and moral ideals," unquote. England remembers that Udall's criticisms, quote, "did us and probably the church significant harm," unquote. The race issue would soon receive some balanced attention in the journal, however. The winter issue that year featured Mormon sociologist Armin Moss with the first full-length article on the subject in his Mormonism and the Negro, Faith, Folklore, and Civil Rights. Unlike Udall, Moss did not attack the church's policy, but sought to refute some of the popular explanations as to why it denied priesthood to members of African descent. Describing as folklore the widely believed views of Apostle Joseph Fielding Smith and his son-in-law Bruce R. McConkie, Moss demonstrated as unscriptural the notion that blacks were less valiant or neutral in the war in heaven or were forever cursed or marked because of the actions of biblical figures Cain and Ham. He also rejected as unsubstantiated the more liberal view that the policy was an infringement on black civil rights as proclaimed by the NAACP in July 1965. 2 years later, Lester Bush, a physician and U.S. Navy lieutenant, wrote a 17-page review of Stephen G. Taggart's book, Mormonism's Negro Policy, Social and Historical Origins, in the winter 1969 issue. Taggart took the view that the priesthood ban was initiated by Joseph Smith in 1834 during the Mormon-Missouri period. Bush countered that Taggart's sources for this view, a belief held by most members even today, were few and too many years after the fact. Bush's work, a prelude to his lengthy 1973 study also published in Dialogue, maintains that the most reliable evidence documents the priesthood restriction as originating with Brigham Young in 1849. These scholarly studies on the Mormon race issue benefited not only the readers of Dialogue, but the church in general, allowing for intelligent response to an enigmatic issue. Such controversial issues as these, and the excessive time and energy required to manage the journal, began to wear on England and Johnson, who found that there was a personal price in their association with Dialogue. Not only was England forced to delay the completion of his graduate work at Stanford, but rumors began circulating in California that he was supposed to be practicing polygamy and was guilty of apostasy. Toward the end of his term, England was saddened to hear that Apostle Boyd K. Packer had predicted publicly that he would be out of the church in 5 years and that his children would leave the church as well because of his activities with Dialogue. Quote, "We've been indoctrinated," laments England, "into thinking that such publications are either official or else they're anti-Mormon. There's no middle ground." In 1970, Johnson became the sole managing editor, and England, by then teaching at St. Olaf's College in Northfield, Minnesota, took the job as planning editor. The following year, the journal was turned over to Robert Reese, an English professor at UCLA. The Johnson-England years had addressed many timely issues. Besides the racial policy, the discovery of the Joseph Smith papyri in 1967, challenging the Book of Mormon, brought forth translations and insights from some of the most renowned Egyptologists in the country. New criticisms regarding Joseph Smith's first vision were addressed in a roundtable featuring Bushman and the Reverend Wesley P. Walters. Leonard Arrington, then president of the Mormon History Association, guest-edited an issue featuring the significance of Joseph Smith's first vision in Mormon thought, path-breaking article by BYU professor James B. Allen. This issue also included several other pieces reevaluating Mormon history. In another issue, readers were introduced to liberal Mormon Bible scholar Heber C. Snell in a roundtable with the more conservative Sidney B. Sperry. Snell, who was, quote, "counting on having a go at Sperry," unquote, examined the use of the Bible in Mormonism. A discussion on Vietnam published later that year featured England, Ray Hillam, John Sorensen, and offered insights from a Mormon perspective on the war. Perhaps the most memorable piece to appear in Dialogue during these years was the sacrament meeting sermon of Richard D. Paul, "What the Church Means to People Like Me," published in the winter 1967 issue. In his speech, Paul addressed the place in the church of liberal and conservative Mormons in his iron rod Liahona dichotomy. The only Dialogue article ever quoted, and negatively, in an LDS general conference, Paul's sermon, delivered in California, has been reprinted numerous times. By 1967, the journal had over 7,500 subscribers. Despite a secondhand report by Elder Packer that in 1975 that Dialogue had caused two young men within the same stake to leave the church, nobody ever told or wrote the editors that they had lost faith in Mormonism. England's experience with subscribers was that the journal had produced an opposite effect. Not only had people reported that dialogue gave them reason to stay in the church, but some credited it for their conversion. Reports such as these were confirmation that there was a place in the church for the type of scholarship that dialogue had been providing. Dialogue study groups were established throughout the church, and the editors were invited to speak at firesides. England describes the period as euphoric. Johnson remembers a certain vitality during the early years that hasn't been repeated since. Dialogue was managed in California until 1976, when it moved to Washington, D.C. under Mary Bradford and her editorship there. In 1982, it moved to Utah for the first time, where it has remained. Three editorial teams have managed the journal here: Jack and Linda Newell from 1982 to 87, Ross and Mary Kay Peterson from 1988 to 1992, and currently Martha Sontag Bradley and Alan Roberts here in Salt Lake City. Okay. When Dialogue moved to Utah, anti-intellectual activity in the church was on the rise. In 1981, Boyd K. Packer criticized historians who used professional standards to write Mormon history. Historian Michael Quinn responded to Packer at BYU, and the debate received national attention in Newsweek magazine. In 1983, Apostle Mark E. Peterson launched an investigation of scholars whose writings earlier appeared in Dialogue, Sunstone, and BYU's independent paper, the Seventh East Press. 2 years later, three apostles ordered Michael Quinn, stake president, to revoke his temple recommend after Dialogue published his LDS Church Authority and New Plural Marriages, 1890 to 1904. Around that same time, Linda Newell and Val Avery were banned from speaking in church on historical topics because they had co-authored Mormon Enigma, a prize-winning yet controversial biography of Emma Smith. 5 years later, Dialogue editor Ross Peterson had lost his temple recommend in an interview with his area presidency because he responded positively to media questions regarding the 1990 changes in the temple ceremony. In 1993, Elder Packer gave his speech criticizing feminists, gays, and so-called scholars as dangers to the church. This was followed a few months later by the disciplinary actions taken against six scholars and feminists who are now known as the September Six. Now, once upon a time, Dialogue's editors were speaking in firesides and traveling around the church and speaking with general authorities, and some were supportive. And we certainly have a different climate now. And I think, in looking at the timing of the events in recent years, I think it's important to understand. I was talking with Armin Moss last night about the McKay era when Dialogue was founded. McKay was open, had kind of a policy of laissez-faire as far as church publications went. People published all along the spectrum, liberals as well as conservatives, and pretty much could do what they wanted. In the first presidency was Hubie Brown at the time, a staunch supporter and liberal Democrat. And when you think of the events that have happened that I just mentioned in the 1980s, all these are timed to where they happened when the first presidency, or at least when the president of the church, was out of commission, was incapacitated. President Kimball gave his last conference talk in 1981, except for a brief one in 1982 where he just basically bore his testimony. So from 81 to 85, he was pretty much incapacitated. And during that period is when Elder Packer gave his speech, when Elder Peterson started his investigation, and when Val and Avery and Linda Newell were banned from speaking in church. Then President Benson comes along. He functions pretty well for about 4 years. By 1989, he's no longer speaking, and his health is deteriorating. And around that time, Ross Peterson loses his temple recommend, and all these things that had happened since up to this September 6th. And Armin Moss talks about this in his book, The Angel and the Beehive. He says that when there's a weakened first presidency due to a incapacitated leader, it, quote, creates a situation that apparently makes it easier for powerful and assertive individuals in the hierarchy or even the civil service bureaucracy to take initiatives of their own at certain times without much restraint from the top. And such a situation creates what he calls small cliques within the hierarchy. And so I believe that while intellectuals are no longer valued in the church, I remain somewhat optimistic that that will change depending on what voices are dominant in the hierarchy. In closing, I have to skip a few things because I'm running out of time. I'd like to quote something that Leonard Arrington said at the 20th anniversary of Dialogue banquet. He said, "I know from personal experience the journal has benefited my generation and the generation of my students and children. I know for a fact that Dialogue has kept many people in the church and in the culture who might otherwise have dropped out. I have received many letters, even from bishops, stake presidents, and general authorities, who have expressed their gratitude for dialogue and indicated what it has meant to them or to someone they loved. Perhaps this is what President Gordon B. Hinckley meant in a conversation with Jack and Linda Newell at the University of Utah, when he said to them in reference to their association with dialogue, quote, "Thank you so much for all the good that you do," unquote. A few days later, Hinckley reaffirmed his feelings to the Newells in a personal note. In a day when dialogue is viewed by many as being in opposition to the institutional church, some may take comfort at the fact that General Authority Marlon Jensen, soon after his 1989 calling to the First Quorum of 70, was able to tell a reporter that he is an avid subscriber to Dialogue magazine. But while such voices in high places may be in the minority, in the end it must be remembered, as Jack Newell said, that, quote, "Dialogue does not exist to please officials. It does not exist to please anyone. It is here to be considered, not to be loved." Paradoxically, that's why some of us have loved it for 30 years. Thank you.
But maybe we're guilty of shedding more heat than light. I don't know. Ideally, it should be the other way around. Well, I'm delighted to be here. And indeed, it is 31 years since some of us got together to talk about an idea that was basically in the wind. It's been mentioned that both Gene England and I had thought about this. There are a lot of other people who were thinking about the possibility of a publication like this. I think the difference is that somehow when our groups, the different people and groups came together at Stanford, that we took action, and that in itself, I think, was rather remarkable, because it's easy to talk about something. It's easy to plan to issue a newsletter. There are a few newsletters or projects for newsletters that were around, but actually, I think, in fact, when we sent out our prospectus, we got word from groups, I think, in Minnesota and Pennsylvania and elsewhere, that they had been thinking about doing this. Even some friends in Santa Barbara, at UC Santa Barbara, had vaguely talked about this. So, as is often the case, as history shows, if there's a need for something, and I think that's basically what was going on here, that eventually that need will be met. And I think it was the privilege and pleasure for those of us who were involved in dialogue to be a part of that. I enjoyed the talk very much. I didn't meet Mr. Anderson until about 10 days ago. And we hadn't had a chance to meet or to discuss. And he did do an interview with me, most of which was not he was unable to draw upon for this paper. But I certainly think that he has a spirit of what went on, and I think the paper on the whole is quite accurate. I have a few small comments to make, and then one or two larger things to discuss. I think that. As I recall, it was rather bizarre that in Palo Alto in 1965, I had come back from overseas. I'd been doing a research project under the Ford Foundation auspices in Africa for several years. I was a new faculty member at Stanford, and I'd heard about this fellow Gene England, but had never met him. And several people said, you know, you really should meet Gene England. But somehow, living in the same town, month after month went by, and we never did meet. And a friend of mine, in fact, my former mission companion, a fellow named Paul Salisbury, who had graduated from Stanford and who came back to Salt Lake, where he was from, to get his master's degree in architecture, had relatives and business in the Bay Area. And during that early period of 1965, he flew into town several times, and he and I would sit there in the part of Stanford complex called Escondido Village and talk about the possibility of some kind of publication. As former mission companions in the French mission, in those days, you were at least under our mission presidency, we were allowed to read intellectual journals. In fact, had four or five different kind of intellectual journals that looked something. This is the first issue of Dialogue that looked something like this. And we were familiar with the French idea of producing an intellectual journal, a journal that would discuss not only things historically, but also current events and current issues. But we didn't do anything about it, and a cheap talk is fairly cheap. And in fact, it is true that a friend of ours, a common friend of ours, Dan Monson, visited the Hoover Institution to do a little research at Stanford, and she suddenly picked up the idea that she was talking to Gene and Francis Menloff and some other people she knew, and then she was talking to Salisbury and myself. And she, you know, she thought, well, this is kind of interesting. Here are these people talking roughly along the same lines. They're all, you know, bursting with energy and wanting to do something, and yet nothing's happening. And so she, I think, served as a very wonderful sort of marriage broker, shall we say, and got us together at that point where I think we instantly realized that we had some of the same goals in mind. But it was, I don't think there was any kind of, you know, vision from on high, but I think there was a pragmatic agreement that something should be done and that Stanford was a very good place to do it. Stanford at that time had a very strong and loyal and active Mormon community. It was far enough away from the center of the church to be protected, shall we say. Yet on the other hand, it was still pretty much in the mainstream. That's the way we felt of ourselves as mainstream Mormons. It was never our intention to do anything to embarrass the church, to play into any kind of anti-Mormon camp. I think if I could quote from the essay I wrote in the first issue, I think in some ways this captures the spirit of the times. And if I could just take a couple of minutes to read from this, a quote from this. I wrote, "Mormons have long remained isolated from their neighbors by choice and by necessity. But today is not the past, however, and most Mormons live outside of Utah." And I think that was part of what was going on there. It was kind of the periphery now that was speaking. "Los Angeles and New York are as important subsidiary centers of Mormon culture now as St. George and Nephi were 50 years ago." And the reason I put that in there is because I had been at Columbia in New York. I had been at UCLA in Los Angeles and seen the truth of this statement. "Today it is not unusual to see Mormon congressmen in Washington, Mormon business executives in Chicago, Mormon professors at Harvard, or Mormon space scientists at Houston. Mormons are participating freely in the social, economic, and cultural currents of change sweeping 20th century America. But Mormons do remain apart from the greater American society. Their experience, their heritage, and tradition of years in isolation remain an integral part of Mormon belief. Mormon doctrine reinforces individual withdrawal and defiance of conformity in the face of modern convention. This new era of life in the secular world, far from the cloisters of a Rocky Mountain Zion, has created a host of dilemmas for the individual who seeks to reconcile faith and reason." And I think that, restated many times, is pretty much what we were representative of, people who were trying to do that. I think in our particular case, we had opted for faith, but we also wanted to have a rational aspect to our testimonies. And then finally, one other paragraph, "A new generation of Mormons has arisen in this process of spreading about the land. Its members are curious, well-trained, and in some cases affluent. They are reflective, energetic, and in most cases committed to church activity. They form study groups and discussion groups to examine their religion and its relevance for contemporary society and culture. They seek to relate religious ideals to issues of everyday secular life." And indeed, that is what the phrase dialogue was all about. Unfortunately, there were some, I'm not sure, either naive or not well-meaning people who said, "Oh, you're trying to carry on a dialogue with the general authorities." That was never our intention. I think the aspect of the notion of dialogue was something that was more in this sort of vein. Let me repeat this. "They seek to relate religious ideals to issues of everyday secular life. They share the faith of their elders, but also possess a restrained skepticism born of the university, the office, and the laboratory. They display an inquiring attitude which favors an open discussion with members inside the Mormon community and pleads for greater communication with those outside of it." I think that's where the dialogue, that was the essence, that was the nub of what dialogue was supposed to be about, where we could discuss among ourselves and we could discuss with people outside the Mormon community. Gene England had many contacts with, in essence, theologians, people in that particular thing. I was interested in history as an historian, with historians who were writing about Mormonism or who wanted to know more about Mormonism. And other editors had their own particular specialties. And finally, to finish this quote, the last couple of sentences, "They have talked to the possibility of a written dialogue, an independent journal of opinion, to capture some of this expression and concern. Indeed, such a possibility has been discussed in many quarters by young Mormons for the past decade." Well, what I'm saying is then, here was an idea that was in the air I think all we did at Stanford was to take the bull by the horns and run with it, so to speak. There easily could have been other groups that did the same thing. One of the things that happened, the response was overwhelming. None of us, I think we all felt we had a good thing because there was a need for it. But still, the response was overwhelming. And I think the very idea was needed because the Improvement Era was the only adult magazine, really, that out there that a church person could read. And as some of you may remember, the Improvement Era had its kind of intellectual department that G. Homer Durham ran, and that was kind of like the resident intellectual, you know, who was supposed to handle all questions and intellectual matters. And in fact, G. Homer is another person we invited to be with us, and at one point he did accept it, later he decided not to. But I think for a younger generation of Mormons that we were representative of at that particular time, having a slot with one intellectual on the Improvement Era was really not enough. I think the thing that was hard for some people, and this is usually people in positions of authority, to really understand is that we were not an opposition group, that we were following, we were emulating other American enterprises, Jewish Americans, Catholic Americans, Presbyterians, the RLDS eventually emulated us, and having, alternative publications. I don't particularly like that word, but publications that were for people who are of the faith who wanted to have an open discussion of matters. And some people didn't fully understand that. Others, I think, embraced that idea very quickly. And that's one reason why we had an avalanche not only of subscriptions, but we had an avalanche of manuscripts. It's been said that it's very true that some of the first manuscripts we got were sacrament meeting sermons that people had stuck in their drawer and they weren't sure whether they were going to publish it, and they sent it to Dialogue, and we, as has been said, Gene and I weeded through these things, and some of them we did publish. As time went on, though, I think one of the functions of Dialogue was to discover new talent, and this I think we're all very proud of. Nurture talent. There was no other place to publish. Now, as time went on, the Exponent 2 started, Sun started, and today we have a variety of publications where people can express their ideas. But back in 1965, that simply wasn't true. And it's really, really kind of odd. Well, let me make one or two quick notations here, and then I'll close. One or two nitpicking things. Dallin Oaks was a professor at the University of Chicago Law School, not the University of Illinois Law School. And we were very pleased when he came on board. Elder Oaks was one of our best reviewers, very conscientious, very even in his judgment on things. If we had doubt about something, very often, if we had three, we always had three reviewers. That was part of our policy. And if we found that there was a divergence of opinion, we very often felt that if Oaks said yay or nay, that it's probably a pretty good indication of what we should do. At that time, he was a professor in Chicago. He was a member of a stake presidency, but he had a good feeling about, you know, what should play and what you shouldn't play. I think also that it's true that Gene was able to recruit a lot of the students, and the students were wonderfully energizing us and working with us. I think there were other people, as I've mentioned, we had some people from the business world, some people, Clayne Robinson, who now teaches opera down at BYU, was an attorney at that time, and he came out to help us. We had other faculty members, Dow Woodward and various other people. We also had volunteer centers in Salt Lake City. Paul Salisbury had a publication group of volunteers here, and Richard Bushman, who was at BYU at that time, had a group of people who helped him down there. So there was a broad gauge sort of volunteer effort that really never ceased to amaze me. Let's see, I have probably, what, about two more minutes? Yeah. Another thing that was, that was very pleasing to us was the fact that we were able to publish a journal that really looked very substantial. My own feeling is this is one reason, and I know it because we had a lot of letters and phone calls, that when this thing came out, it was not just about a, you know, 30-page sort of thing. We had how many pages did we have in the first issue? We had about 170 pages in the first issue. Other issues, Leonard Arrington, I think, several issues later, we came out with a history issue edited by Brother Arrington, and this had 200 pages. I think one of the crucial things that did help us out, because the historians were very favorable to us and have we published a lot of historians, is that the Mormon History Association deferred starting a journal for a few years. And they decided that they would publish in Dialogue. And that helped us in terms of getting some very strong manuscripts. And this issue was very, very well received, I think particularly in the scholarly community. And I felt, as a scholar, that we had arrived when I began seeing, as quoted in the New York Times or various other sources, that the Dialogue was taken seriously as an enterprise that could be quoted by scholars. That seemed to happen at the very beginning, and it certainly is true down to the present. And that I think scholars who go for tenure or for promotion or whatever, I've never heard of anybody who has had an article rejected by an administration or something for being a second-rate article. If it's published in Dialogue, why, it's usually accepted and always is accepted, as far as I know, as something that has been serious and has been reviewed. And I think the collective responsibility was our kind of major philosophy. Someone said, well, how do you know that you're going to do things right? And we said, we really don't know. We really don't know. But I think we have a collective faith that of all of us working together that will kind of counterbalance each other. And I think that's particularly true of Gene and myself. We're very different persons. Gene was in English literature and theology, and I was in history. We had somewhat different backgrounds, but I think the main thing is we had a vision. And Devery asked me in my interview the other day if whether Gene and I ever had difference of opinion. I said, sure we did. But I think the main thing is we always came to closure, as I recall. Gene's sitting here. I don't want to say something I may regret. But I think we always came to closure on the important issues. And I think that as we move forward, why, we were a team that got things done. And by and large, if you're running a journal and you have to produce that journal every 3 months, that's the bottom line. And that's something we were able to do. We never had in those early years a double issue. Whenever you go to a double issue, people say, ooh, I'm getting ripped off on my subscription. I'm expecting 4 issues a year, and now they're cutting me down to maybe 2 or 3. And I think that kind of regularity, I think, is something that helped establish the credibility of Dialogue. Let me just respond. There are other things in here I'd like to respond to. We don't have time. The Udall affair was probably, at least while we were editors, as I recall, was the article that got the most press in terms not only outside the church but also inside the church. I had an interesting relationship in this thing because I'm from Arizona, and the Udall family is probably one of the 2 or 3 most prestigious LDS families in the state. And my family has political connections to the Udalls. And when we sent out a letter turning down the article that Mr. Udall had sent us, I had people calling me and saying, we can't believe it. You, Johnson, from Arizona, you're turning down a fellow compatriot, a man who was Kennedy's Secretary of the Interior. How can you do this? Well, the fact of the matter is that I think that Mr. Udall wanted to use Dialogue for a political platform. Now, on the whole, I mean, most of the editors agreed with what he was talking about, that the church should have a pro-Negro policy. But on the other hand, the way he was stating it, and given his political background, it was really not the right time and the right place. But I defend the solution we finally hit upon, and that was that if you want to send a letter to the editor, we will print that as a letter to the editor at a free open forum. And I guess you'd all gnash his teeth, but he finally did that, and that's what we finally published. Even so, we caught a lot of flack for that. I think Gene, I guess, in his interview said he kind of regretted doing that. I don't. I think it was a statement that we had to make to establish our credibility in a number of quarters. And I think it did, my own feeling is it did a lot of good. I, again, am not certain that I would, again, favor the idea of forwarding anybody's political career. But still, I think I would go with the idea that we did the right thing in publishing it. Well, I've enjoyed being here. This has been a lot of fun to reminisce about Dialogue and its founding 31 years ago. There was a fantastic vibrancy, euphoric atmosphere that did take place, and one of the reasons is because first of all, we found so many people who are willing to be on our board of editors, people all over the country who are willing to, you know, come with us, and that's always been true. Found innumerable people, very important people of faith and reason who believed in the Dialogue ideal. And secondly, I think, as I mentioned before, the fact that we discovered new talent and nurtured new talent. And I think, in the larger sense, I think Dialogue has played its part as Sunstone, Exponent, and other publications in helping to develop a community of Mormon intellectuals. Now, to me, intellectuals is not a dirty word. I'm sorry. I teach intellectual history at BYU. And an intellectual can be a respected and should be a respected member of society. And I feel that Dialogue has helped to nurture and help forward the cause of Mormon intellectuals. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Go ahead.
What's the subscription count today?
What's the subscription count today?
I think that we print about 5,000 bookstores.
Other than bother me, I think if you look at intellectual journals, I think Dialogue essentially has an intellectual journal because it's a refereed journal and it has a scholarly format. There are intellectual journals in this country that have maybe 1,500, 2,000 subscribers who have an enormous impact. And I think it's not a journal for everybody. And I'd like to see more subscribers, but on the other hand, I think that number of people subscribing to a journal is commensurate with the levels of the subscription of a number of other journals.
It's got a renewal rate of over 90%, and that is probably a fairly loyal core.
One thing that's important, too, is the shadow readers, too. Like, many of the ones that buy in stores are
people who borrow a subscriber's copy. And when I was talking to Gene England a while back, you said, Gene, that you heard often that up to a dozen people were reading, the same issue. And so for the influence it has, certainly goes beyond just the number of subscribers that it has at any time. I think that's important to remember. I mean, it must be somewhat influential because once in a while they take jabs at it in conference, that they're referring to something that was said or done. So sometimes we hear that what does it matter, just a few people out of all these millions of members, but then you realize that there's obviously more of a voice here than you're led to believe sometimes.
I just want to say, discovering Dialogue is like finding an oasis in the desert. It's a hallelujah. I'm a 52-year-old doctor.
Anything else? Go ahead.
I just like to see if there's some perspective from anyone in the room on how to help someone come to terms with that sort of referee sort of format. If I share it with someone, say, hey, here's a very good article, that's very positive for the church and so on, they may read it and say, yeah, it is. And then I'll read another article that may challenge their beliefs and then just shut down totally to the whole idea, and maybe even have a certain skepticism of me or my faith. How is there any perspective on that? Can it help people see what good that does?
Well, I think it's a phrase that Gene used. It's been used by others, but Gene used to use it quite a bit, and that is the life of the mind. And I think that's really what Dialogue was all about. It was a cultivation of the life of the mind. And let's face it, not everybody's interested in the life of the mind. The life of the mind, I think, implies a certain give and take. Ideally, that's also the ideal of the university, where you have a give and take. And I think, in many ways, what Dialogue was doing was introducing that ideal to some people, perhaps, who hadn't really thought too much about it. Some embraced it as desirable. Or you could be challenged. On the other hand, you could find substantiation for perhaps your point of view. There were some people who were not. My mother-in-law was one of those people who not being taped. Who she loyally subscribed, because blood is thicker than water. But boy, she was upset sometimes. But I think that many people were that way. But I think our goal was to try to cultivate the life of the mind.
Yeah. I may, but I can't even believe, but where you said that things like that, is there some place, some kind of source where we have people that, authority, these people respect, it's not really condemned by the church. I know that some individuals officially, to my knowledge, been. In fact, some Levant is doing some good. I mean, is there some kind of source material for that?
I don't want to hog the microphone here, but the reality is when dialogue, we're talking about the early years of dialogue, there were various people in authority who privately shared with us their feeling that maybe dialogue could bring about some good. And we're talking about a half dozen or more general authorities. I think, and I'm going to paraphrase Gene England, but he visited with N. Eldon Tanner one time, who said, you know, in Canada, and he was Canadian, we have a thing called the loyal opposition. And it's part of the way we think up there. Nobody accuses the loyal opposition of being traitors or being apostates or anything. That's just part of the system. And he said, I'd like to... Am I right, Gene? Is this... Am I?
Well, I think it's nice to know the president's mouth. You know, the troops are no place for loyal opposition. So I think we're in a historical cycle here that I don't understand as well as I'm remarkable. In some ways, it's remarkable that we do have 4,000. In my optimism, when we had 8,000, I thought, well, when the church doubles, we'll have 16,000. And when it doubles again, we'll have 32, and it's doubled twice since then, so you'd expect 32,000. But the fact is, we probably don't have as many intellectuals now as we had in 1967. The converts coming in are not intellectuals. And the church's emphasis on meeting the needs of converts is diminished its interest in nurturing intellectuals. I think we have in some ways a much more vibrant intellectual atmosphere in the church in the 50s and 60s than we do today. So I think this point is the young people going up in the church. And what I see and talk to people, they don't have that fervent desire to think about the gospel that I had when I was in my friends in the 50s and 60s. And who formed a natural audience for that. So the young people today aren't a natural audience. So in some ways I think it's remarkable that Alan can keep 4,000 subscribers.
Well, I think, you know, I work for Benchmark Books while I'm going to school, and we get people in all the time that have just discovered the journal. They're now excited. They're sharing it with their friends. We have all these back issues for real cheap, and they buy those up and go home and devour them. And when I think of the people who've probably fallen away from the church, people who think, who've been alone, haven't known of any source they can go to or any group they can meet with, no one to talk to that have left the church, I think that's really sad when you think that they would embrace dialogue if they knew where it was or if they knew that it was in existence. And so the need is still there, definitely. And I think we need to figure out some way to, like you said, originally it was geared towards helping the young people, college-age students who are now doing a lot of thinking and trying to square worldly learning with their religion. And those people still exist. I take an institute class once in a while, and you know, I see some of the questions being asked and some of the frustrations there. And so... you know, we need to get the word out a little better, because I think there are a lot of people that will be grateful if we do.
We'll take one more.
I've been getting mixed. My understanding is that there's both dialogue symptoms to the church on the church are not intellectual in their last experience. They're intellectual views. But I'm only aware of those that happen in California. I don't know that there's people in. You know, we're getting most of our converts down to Florida. I don't know. There's no intellectual incentive there. I don't understand. My question is, are we really under pressure? Are we winning the battle, or are we losing?
Well, let me respond to that. I'm as a BYU professor, I would say this, that I'm sure Gene needs to respond to this, too, before we close. I came to BYU 12 years ago from the rather bracing intellectual climate of the University of California. And I was very pleased in coming to BYU, and I was recruited by the Holland administration. I did not seek to come to BYU. I was recruited. If anything, I was wined and dined in the best sense of those phrases, because they told me they wanted a more open society, and they felt that people like me, who had been kind of out, you know, in California, would be valuable to them. And so I finally came to BYU on a two-year trial basis, and I liked what I saw. I liked the Hall administration. I liked the openness of some of the people who were in different positions there, and I thought in some ways that maybe we were entering a new era. That all changed in the next few years, And I think one of the indications of that is when I first came, they said, yeah, we're going to hire non-Mormon scholars. We find a college, if a department finds a scholar who can make a valuable contribution and he's non-LDS and he meets the standards of the church, we'll hire him. That policy was closed down within several years. I think that's an indication of the fact that I think the institution, the wagons began to draw around the campfire, so to speak. Finally, my feeling is, too, that some of the students I see today, as opposed to, say, 10 or 12 years ago, I think are very much part of an establishment. I mean, what is there to fight for in the sense that Mormonism is recognized, they see the BYU library, Mormonism is accepted here and there. I think some of us of a younger generation, one of the reasons perhaps we felt so vibrantly about things is that we were still seeking to establish an identity, still trying to seek a place for ourselves. I'm not sure that some of the students today feel that way. I'm not sure that that's on their agenda. Their agenda may be quite different. And that may be one reason why there are only 4,000 subscribers. But that doesn't discourage me. I still think that any community has to have its intellectuals. As a professor of history, I can assure you, I teach World Civ at BYU. And that's one of my messages, is that one of the things that makes history go and that makes communities succeed is where there is an intellectual tradition which is kept alive. And that's why it's so important for Sunstone and Dialogue and other groups to stay alive, because we owe it to our community to be there through thick and through thin.